appreciated the wonderful fireworks that we apparently saw last night. The well-timed fireworks. Three presentations slash interactive discussions. Thank you, Erin. We're going to start with Dr. Lisa Becton this morning. She's the Director of Swine Health Information and Research at the National Pork Board, and is the co-chair of the National Pork Board Swine Health Committee as well. She oversees the NPB Swine Health Research Programs, Emerging and Endemic Diseases, and PERS for Proposals. Dr. Becton disseminates information gained from the Swine Health Committee, funded research to targeted audiences in a variety of kind of media formats. She coordinates and collaborates with different government and veterinary producer organizations to try and represent the interests of the pork industry. So this morning, Lisa's going to give us an update on PED.
I apologize ahead of time. No veterinary presentation is good without pictures, but hopefully there's not too many of them, and if you don't like seeing ducks in the morning, just look away. Thanks for that invite. I'm just going to cover kind of sort of the state of the union on PED. I apologize if some of this is somewhat remedial. Plagiarism is always a fun thing. I did a presentation yesterday for Utah pork producers, so a lot of that I presented at that meeting for producers is going to be on this review. And then also I want to thank Joe Connor up front with Carthage Veterinary Services, because he provided a lot of the pictures that I'll show you guys. This next slide. So what I'm going to do is just kind of overview the disease. Oh, crud. The actions to manage PED, some of the recommendations that have come about. The current status of both the epidemiology survey that AASV is doing, and then also some of the research that's ongoing. So what's happened initially, we did get our first confirmation, or officially it was on May 16th of this year. That was through the National Veterinary Services Labs in Ames, Iowa, and that was on PCR positive samples. Just to reiterate, this has been a really coordinated effort between a whole lot of entities and agencies. A lot of folks are saying, where the heck have USDA been in? They haven't done any quarantines, and I'll get into that in just a minute. But it has been a very coordinated effort between veterinary groups, producer groups, and governmental groups, as well as state. So next slide.
Oops.
This is a diarrheal disease, so just like we've been reiterating, it is a production disease of swine. It is something that we have seen before, at least in the form of TGE. So it is something that has been around, or at least TGE has been around. PEDV is an RNA virus, so that'll be interesting as we continue on in the year with the different cases to see whether or not that genome changes. It is an envelope coronavirus, so it's in the same family, obviously, as TGE. However, with coronavirus, especially in some of our media efforts, we're trying to downplay that a bit, because I'm sure some of the questions could come up as far as its relation to some of this Mediterranean human coronavirus, and there's no relation. Fecal-oral transmission, so again, I know that's fun breakfast discussion, but that's how it is transmitted, through manure. So next slide. When we've talked to a lot of media outlets, and a lot of these lately have been non-agricultural, so again, a lot of the focus that I've been doing is trying to help some of our non-agricultural friends from the New York Times, Bloomberg, Reuters, NPR, AP, all those folks be able to understand in relative lay terms what this virus is and isn't. So while we are telling folks, yes, this is a new virus to the U.S., but it is not a new virus worldwide. We do know it's been in Europe as well as in Asia, including Japan, South Korea, Thailand, and China. So it is out there in the sphere, and now obviously it's here in the U.S. It is a production disease. We hope that it will be able to be controlled, managed, and maybe even eliminated. Time will tell whether or not we get to that point. Let's see, what it is not, and again, I did write up here, this is what we are highlighting with our non-ag folks, because a lot of people want to have a more sensational story and be able to understand it, but these are a lot of things that I've been highlighting with folks. This is not a regulatory disease. It is not zoonotic. We've had questions even on, is this like influenza, or God forbid the word swine flu, don't repeat me on that, but we've had a lot of people still misunderstand that this is not influenza, this is not a zoonotic disease, it is only a disease of pigs. Right now, from other regulatory standpoint, it is not listed as a national reportable disease with the United States or with OIE. There are no trade restrictions within the United States, or at least state-to-state, interstate restrictions or movement. We do have one international trading partner that has put restrictions on live animal imports, and that currently is Mexico. But that is the only nation that we know of currently that has any restrictions on anything as far as it relates to our PEDV status. So next slide. So what are the symptoms? Again, very similar to TGE. It's a disease of the gastrointestinal system. I've heard a wide-ranging array of clinical signs. Obviously, it is the worst on sow farms, as is TGE, and it can be in including up to 100% mortality on baby pigs, especially 7 days or less, but even up to 3 weeks or less. Have heard even of some continuation of this problem is upwards of 7 or 8 weeks after the initial infection. Normally, the course of disease seems to run about 4 to 5 weeks, and then it starts to abate. Older animals, such as sows, grow finish, nursery pigs, obviously will have the morbidity, but not the associated mortality with this disease. So this is start of the picture, so close your eyes if you don't have pictures. This is some of the signs of baby pigs. Obviously, you can see a lot of fecal staining, very dehydrated, emaciated pigs, and the death loss from the babies is really due to dehydration. So next slide. This shows a progression, essentially, where you start in day one with normal, healthy-looking pigs. Once day two, they start to get ingest that virus, and then you can see the progression up until day five, where they do perish. A lot of times, the death loss can happen quicker, but that's really what's going on with this disease. This is another slide that Joe had shared from China, that it shows, obviously, the same presentation on the litters. You can see on the pigs, the very emaciated animals that just don't have that body condition because it's literally all going out the back end. Normal looking scours, or not normal looking, but you can have a wide presentation of scours. And then on D, slide D, where the you look at the intestines clinically of affected pigs. Normally the pathology, I used to look at it, if you can not see through intestines, then you knew it was probably not rotavirus or something that denudes the intestinal lining. However, with PED or even TGE, you'll have a very flaccid, very see-through intestines because they're basically the enterocytes, the villi and the crypts are basically obliterated. So you'll have a very thin-walled intestines, milk-filled stomachs, a lot of gas, but there's just nothing much there. And then pathology, I'm not a good pathologist, so I'll agree. It always gave me a headache. Okay, so finishers, feeders, again, we can still see the morbidity, so you'll see clinical signs because all ages of animals are affected. Again, it can range from basically inapparent or very minimal clinical signs to they paint the walls out of both ends. So you'll see different signs of depression and anorexia just because they're feeling really bad. Signs of abdominal pain, they may sit on their stomachs and just kind of not want to move because they just feel really bad. If any of you have ever had any GI distress from food poisoning, which I hope you haven't, but if you've had, you know that it does not feel good and those animals feel the same way. Have heard some instances where there's a severe metritis, mastitis, and agalactia conditions occur in sows, and some of that may be physiologically related to all of a sudden that sow's, you know, getting into full milk and then all her litter's gone and she's got nowhere to release that milk to. But it is something to be aware of because in issues of that disease, you need to manage those sows to get her through that particular part and also to make sure that it doesn't go on to a more clinical systemic disease. So again, morbidity can pretty much cover 100% of the herd, and if you're at a sow farm, you want it to cover 100% of the herd just for building immunity and then eventual rumination. But everybody's going to be sick, but mortalities or death loss just depends on the age of the pig that are affected. Again, you can't really see it on this one, but there's some puddling manure on the back ends of the sow. This sow, you can see she's kind of had an explosive diarrhea. The white stuff is lime. We used to use that when we were dealing with TGE. One, for worker safety, because when you're walking behind the slats, it gets kind of slick. But then also just to have a little bit of a drier area to help absorb some of the manure so it's not splashing all over either. Again, it comes back to that fecal-oral transmission. If you can reduce the spread, hopefully you can reduce the transmission. This is clinical signs, at least in the nursery, a wean to finish barn. Again, you'll just see loose stools and the slats around the feeders. There's a close-up picture, and then the middle picture, really, you can see a lot of pigs are gant, sucked up. Some of them may have a little bit of fecal staining on their rear ends. I don't really see any. Some people will utilize creep mats. I don't like the rubber mats for control of this, only because they become one big soupy mess. However, we have used things like compostomats that can be a bit more absorbent, still provide a little bit of environmental protection for the pigs. You can put some creep feed on it if you need to, and then eventually you can even use it for feedback if that's something you want to do. But in this type of situation, when you have a lot of scours, I don't recommend using non-porous materials for a creep area just because it gets to be a bloody mess. Diagnostics. This whole area is still ever evolving. Most of all of the major swine diagnostic laboratories, especially Minnesota and Iowa State, are really up to date and moving forward with continuing to validate, develop, and even improve the tests that we've currently got. Most of these are all still viral-based, so PCR and antigen-based. We are working on some other diseases like IFA and IHC, the immunohistochemistry. Those are in the works and still being developed. But till now, we still don't have a good serologic test, and I'll get into that in a minute later of why. But again, the swine labs, just to help support all of those guys, have done an excellent job stepping up to the plate to get these tests into play, to get them standardized, and to get them, you know, to let producers know and veterinarians know that they're out there and for use. So as far as a rapid response, I don't know if we could have asked for any better. We are still encouraging producers to get a definitive diagnosis. That question came up yesterday, you know, so what if it scours? If we got it, who cares? Well, there are some different treatment alternatives when you look at what type of diarrhea it is. I've seen really hard rotaviruses that'll knock out farrowing houses. They won't attack the adults, but it's important to know that. PEDV obviously has no treatment and no vaccine options, whereas TGE has at least some vaccine options and potentially some cross-protection with porcine respiratory coronavirus. So it really is important, though, to be able to identify where those cases are cropping up, because still you want to make sure you can hone in your management and control strategies to deal with that virus. So what's the current status? AASV is the one that right now is posting the status report from USDA. USDA is gathering information from all the National Animal Health Laboratory Network labs, which really essentially encompasses all the major swine production states. But Dr. Sarah Tomlinson is gathering that information, and really what it includes is the number of states, the number of positive cases, and then the number of positive samples. So we do know we have positive samples identified in 15 states. There are up to 334 individual cases that have been identified. From the first isolate, we do know that it was 99.4% similar to a 2012 Chinese isolate that's been deposited in GenBank. I know there's been some additional isolates deposited in GenBank since then. I haven't gone through and looked at or asked anybody as far as what the genetic similarity are between all of these new isolates. I think they're relatively similar at this time. I don't think I've heard of anything of being genetically divergent. So we're remaining relatively the same of what we're seeing, and I think that would be expected. There was some archive samples that were taken because the big question is, was it here before May? Do we know where it was? Do we know how long it's been here? Have we missed that? At least at several different labs, there was some testing done, and the samples that found, the earliest there was anything found was early April. So we think we have one of the index cases was mid-April in Ohio. And so that's helped us at least hone in and identify where some of this might be coming from. So this sampling of it, everything positive to date has been from positive pigs. You know, there was questions about feed and feed being a suspect. There was some early investigations on some premix, and the premixes that were tested were actually from the feed mill. They weren't tested on farm. Some of those indicated an early positive PCR on a feed test, but were subsequently negative on a bioassay, which means when they took the positive PCR samples, processed it, rehydrated it, put it back into negative pigs, those pigs did not seroconvert, or they did not get the disease. So far, even though we may have had some positives on PCR for feed, we have had no subsequent positives on bioassay. There is still some testing going on, and I'll get into some other things that are going to happen with feed here in a minute. Oh, no, you're fine. Risk areas, really the things that we're looking at as we talk to both practitioners on farm that have had some of the first outbreaks, as well as people that are trying to prevent some of the lateral spread. Transportation is the biggest. Still looking at a high-risk movement because, obviously, we've got to move pigs, whether they're going to call markets, they're going to the slaughter plant, they're going to their other farm. If you have different stages, we have to move pigs. So it's really important to look at the cleanliness and sanitation because of that fecal oral spread. So that's something that we're trying to get the word out to producers for management and addressing. Not that people aren't already, but sometimes due to cost concerns and things like that, we may not be as vigilant as we should be. A lot of people say, yeah, we need to look at the trailer, but there's also the areas of the truck because drivers tend to walk around places and then get back into their cab and can contaminate the cab very easily. So fomites, things that you know can get in manure and carry manure, but not necessarily be a pig thing. So boots, contaminated clothing, sort panels, panels on trailers, even just the people side can transmit the virus. And same thing with mortality disposals. We don't normally think of a dead pig as maybe being such a high risk because he's not going to travel anywhere. However, dead animals can still contaminate an area and present a risk to other naive animals. So that whole process is something to reevaluate on how each and individual farm or system removes their dead and secures everything along in that process. The other one that was brought up is contract power washers. A lot of people don't, especially smaller farms, don't necessarily have their own power wash systems and contract with other people to do that. Well, what are those guys doing? They're going to wash a dirty farm and get in contact with manure, shavings, and a lot of other organic, potentially contaminated things. Not just in the site and on hoses while they're washing, but as those hose reels get reeled back into the trailer. So that's something to keep in mind. If you've ever gone and inspected any of those, it's amazing how dirty they can get. So that's another area of risk for focus. So reduction of risk, really washing all trailers. There is a recent study published by Dr. Matthew Turner, and that is available on the AASB website, looking at call markets and chutes that's identified positive PEDV, and we know that's a high risk. So really, it is important that all trailers are evaluated and washed because that has to bump up to something, and it's going to have to bump up to something that's not owned by the farm. So especially important, like I said, for culls, for markets, even farm to farm, to wash, to dry, make sure they're properly disinfected with enough contact time. And again, if you can dry them or heat treat them, that's great. If not, they at least should be disinfected to help denature the virus. We've got some disinfectants there listed. I know questions have come up about Synergize. I know Preserve International is doing some trials. I've not seen any data from them, but I do know they're evaluating that product because when a lot of the earlier research was done for TGE, that product was not even out there. So that's an underway, and I'm sure that will be found to be good. We've had several calls from a bunch of people, God bless them, trying to come out and say that they've got good products too. I always ask, do you have EPA approval? Are they approved for use in food production and in animal sites before we look at those? And if anybody calls you guys, if you want to send it my way, that's fine. We don't necessarily ourselves do research. But if there's information that's out there, it would be interesting to look at and at least then to set up with people who can do the research on those type things. Survival, right now we looked at manure. It can survive at 122 degrees, but not at 140. So when heat treating things such as trailers, 140 for 20 minutes will decrease or get rid of the virus. There are some things, again, that we're looking at on survivability that I'll cover when we get to the research side, just because we have some baseline for TGE, but some of the data for PEDV is a little bit iffy. And also, we want to make sure we can make our research relevant to our conditions in the U.S. Again, transportation, I know we keep beating up on that, but even to the point of third-party audits are making sure somebody looks at trailers. When I was in production, we used to have people that's all they did is to climb in trailers, in the afternoons when they were done. I think Marie and I, the first time, you were still at PIC and I was at PSF, we would come in and crawl around trailers and just look, what's the degree of contamination, where do things hide, and really stressing with people that just because it may look clean doesn't mean it really is clean. So that's a focus area, and it helps to give a people that are washing the trailers a benchmark of how they're doing. So I do recommend that if at all possible. Wash the floors between trailers, really to focus on the clean, dirty areas. And then disinfection. Again, same thing with the boots closing. Clothing and everything that's used in the truck wash, end of the day, always a good thing basically to break down that site, clean up the floors, clean up the clothing, clean up your areas, and then make sure everything is put up for the night to dry as best as possible. Other areas, obviously buildings, when you're trying to get to the point now and you've exposed the herd and you want to clean it up after they've been through the break, just to try to have things like changing shoes, showering and out if at all possible, even inspection of loading chutes for clean, dirty lying. Is it secure? Is it enclosed or covered? Keep birds out, keep roads out, keep other people out. Just all the basics of biosecurity. And like I said, a lot of this may be basic and redundant, but these are the things that we're stressing with producers as well, regardless of size or operation, just to help protect themselves. Same thing with lean-to-market barns. Again, just have separation of people. If you don't need to have folks in, don't. Inspections of the office and the barns when you're trying to clean them up, make sure people aren't doing things they shouldn't be doing. Plastic booting as far as visitors, and then showering them out. So just some really basic things. Next slide. Let's see. Dead disposal again. It is a risky activity, but it's one that we have to do. You know, whether you're rendering, composting, or hauling animals off-site, it's just trying to go back and reassess how are you pulling animals out of the farm, how are you doing that safely. Is that an internal thing or is it an external? Where are your risk points, and then trying to address those. We had all internal trailers that hauled dead stock from the farm out to a third location, and there was a clean and dirty separation between the dumpster, essentially, and our trailer, and those two never connected. But it's always good, regardless of what system you're using, is to assess each and every point to make sure there's a definitive clean and dirty line that you're not crossing or your folks are not crossing. Again, if you can move it off-site, that's even better. If you don't have to do it on-site, great. But if you do, you know, make sure, again, that you have somewhere you can disinfect and clean facilities and your equipment. Next. Isolation, quarantine, obviously that's a key. When you're having to bring animals back into the unit, especially after a length of time, you just want to make sure that those gilt production sites aren't ones that have broke. If they have appropriate downtime and track those animals. Again, it's a little bit difficult because we don't have a serologic mechanism to be able to tell exposure. So we may have to at least currently use a little bit more sentinel animals to see if they do have clinical signs of disease. I think down the road we will have a serology test, but right now it's just clinical observations. Do they have diarrhea or not? Control really is very similar to TGE. Again, I've heard some various reports of people that have had early farms that some of them it has been easy to expose, and some of those farms are now coming out of it, but I've also heard that even with some traditional measures, some of the farms are still really struggling, at least on the sow site. Weaned to finish nursery sites, especially if they're all in or out, seems to be a little bit different or easier to manage. But the sow farms are presenting a little bit of a different picture. Feedback really is the biggest one right now. You know, self-imposed quarantine, at least until that herd can recover, is some of the things that people are doing. Obviously, if you're having to wean, you guys know how to handle and monitor those movements and make sure that you're, you know, keeping infected animals in one flow or one location and dedicating trailers and things to do that. A lot of questions have come up about treatment. Obviously, since it's viral, there is no antimicrobial treatment for that. Really, it's supportive care. The baby pigs, you know, it's timely and necessary euthanasia once they get sick because there really is no good way to support those little guys. Some of the older animals, hydration, electrolytes, even some aspirin. Sometimes it is recommended to use some secondary antimicrobials for E. coli or salmonella because those are opportunistic pathogens that when you have the damage of the lining of the intestines, you may see those diseases crop up. So if you have a nursery that does have an aggressive scour, sometimes it is worthwhile to go in with a neomycin or Garrison or something like that just to help tamp down some of the secondary bacterials. Environment is a big one because these guys are going to be scouring, they're going to be losing a lot of body fluids, upping the temperatures a little bit while still maintaining some ventilation to help things dry out. you know, the use of lime or even bistrol to try to keep the pigs dry can be of help, again, just so that they're not losing all that water and just shivering and cold. So there's some other environmental things you can do. We do not currently have an approved vaccine in the United States. It was funny, I was on a plane ride back home with CBD folks, and you know, we just don't have a product right now for PEDV. And the current TGE products, at least in discussions with our folks and friends in South Korea, do not cross-protect for PEDV. So even though TGE is out there, it really is worthless for control of PEDV. So we are looking at vaccines. Obviously, that's probably going to be 6 months plus down the road. TGE vaccines, any of you that have used any of those, they're kind of okay at best. They do help some, but they're not a cure-all, and they do not absolutely shut down the course of the disease. So I can't really anticipate that even if we do get a PED vaccine, that it's going to do the same thing, absolutely stop all clinical signs. It may reduce them, but time will tell, and we'll have to see. So next steps. AASV has done an initial survey on a lot of these first farms that broke. Harry Snelson and Tom Berkren have been leading up that charge with American Association of Swine Veterinarians, so we'll go through that. And then there is going to be a secondary investigation for lateral spread of the disease headed by Bob Morrison out of University of Minnesota, and that one's getting underway. They've developed that survey module and are going to proceed with getting producers to participate and go from there. So I'll just go briefly through what the survey is. Again, they really wanted to look at what are the first cases that were identified and broke. Any stage of production really didn't matter whether it was a sour, grow, finish, although we wanted to know that information. The goal was to look at risk factors and what are the commonalities between those first farms that broke, and is there anything that can point to that's got a high odds of potentially being associated with the disease that we can focus in on even further for investigation. And then really characterize the clinical presentation. You know, up front, we had a lot of really good interaction with practitioners and still do. But like I said, the clinical presentation that we're seeing can be really, really variable. So we wanted to try to hone in and see, okay, on these first farms, what did this disease look like, and can we characterize it a little bit better? And then at the end, also include negative cases or negative herds, because even though you may have a risk factor that has a high association with infected farms, if you don't have those negative controls to compare against, you may mistake or misassociate a risk factor that really does not have an impact. So we felt it was really important to have negative case controls there for the survey comparison. You can see the information. We've got herd type, nearby farms, biosecurity. A lot of these questions were necessarily broad because, again, you're kind of doing that first initial fishing expedition. You want to throw the net out and see what you catch. So if we made it too narrow, we might not be finding anything at all. So take that with a grain of salt as you look at some of the information, because it does cut a wide swath of what we're trying to get. I also wanted to mention with this, there always is issues with confidentiality of data and information. Right now, AASV is the lead organization that holds all this information. And when we get into data analysis, AASV shares certain aggregate data with the groups that are analyzing the data. So that way, individual producer, premise IDs, site locations, and all that, that is maintained only by AASV and is not going out to the general public whatsoever. Other things that we're looking at are inputs on the farm, so semen, vaccines, premixes, proteins. Again, there was a lot of question on feeds and what was a commonality during this break. So those are some of the things that are being evaluated. Characterization, you can see what's here, trying to answer that. So again, clinical signs, onset, morbidity, mortality. Did they get diagnosis? How long does it take to recover? So those basic things. So for the data analysis, again, AASV holds the database that has all this individual farm information. The National Center for Foreign Animal and Zoonotic Disease Defense are run by Tammy Beckham. They're down at Texas A&M. They're the ones that have a database system that can take a lot of this information and make it epidemiologically evaluatable. So they can set up a lot of the data fields and make them standardized. And so then somebody like CEA, the Center for Epidemiology and Animal Health, can come in and analyze that data. Because it's really hard if you don't have it in a standardized collection format then to do any kind of assessment with any kind of assuredness. So FASD is helping out. USDA has helped out. Obviously, we support with some funding, as well as national pork producers. Liz Wagstrom, their chief veterinarian, spent a lot of time in this data collection and survey process. Excuse me. So who participated? There was 19 vets on this first survey. There was 43 returned. I apologize, I can't remember how many were sent out. I think it was like 50 some odd, maybe, or close to that. So we got 25 positives, 18 negatives. There was 19 states represented that were positive cases, and then one state with a negative control. So I do have, Harry had just sent out yesterday some of the initial preliminary summaries on this. I obviously have not had a chance to read through the whole thing, but they do have identified at least seven different factors, and most of those are associated with feed that had the higher odds of being associated with a PED case. There was some of the things that had a low odds ratio that was somewhat protective. The only thing that they're looking at right now is trying to take, again, the survey with a grain of salt because it does have low numbers. So even though we're looking at there is an association and an odds of an activity, there still needs to be further investigation. So what's going to be happening, obviously, since AASV just sent this out, we'll be working with their swine health committee, our swine health committee, getting this published out to practitioners, NPPC, and other stakeholders. It did go to USDA because there's a collaborative group in states that are working on this. So really, we'll have to look at what are our next steps, and that's probably going to be some additional feed investigation. So I'll tell about that. So what we're going to do from our side is we made a research call. We want to get all those finalized, contracts written, and get them implemented. And then obviously our goal is to get information back out to you all as rapidly and as quickly as we can. Thanks. So with that said, on the research side, our board approved $450,000 for use in PEDV. We don't normally have an emergency management fund, as much as I love to say that we do. What happens, though, is during the course of the year, the way our board budgets fund, we always have a certain degree of reserve capacity to be able to address issues just like this, or if it's a marketing issue or something else. So back in June, after this had broke, my boss, Dr. Paul Sundberg, went to our board and said, hey, we've got some research priorities and needs outlined that we have listed here. We're really looking at requesting some additional support to get all that done. So the board agreed unequivocally and said, yep, here you go. The other thing is, in fact, everybody's heading out tomorrow to the board meeting on Monday. We will potentially need additional funding, and we've identified several key areas. So he's going to make an additional ask for those monies for some additional research needs, and I'll cover those here in a sec. So what we have funded to date, these are the actual studies. I can't tell you what university is doing everything, only because we're still trying to get the contracts finalized because there's been some negotiations with that. But these are the titles of the actual proposals. So for viral pathogenesis, we really want to know where is the virus, you know, localized? Is it in tonsil? Is it just locally in the intestines or the GI system? Does it go anywhere else? How long does it shed before and after infection? Is there a carriage or a carrier stain? Do we know? What's the antibody response? Is there aerosol transmission, or is it just a carrier state where there's so much environmental contamination and that virus just goes as moisture droplets or manure droplets elsewhere? So that's one of the things that we want to know. Environmental stability, we're looking at the evaluation of time and temperature to kill it on metal surfaces, aka trailers. Let's see, next. Diagnostics, obviously we're continuing to focus on that. So development and validation of diagnostic testing for antigen and antibody detection for PEDV. I do want to make a note, a lot of these efforts are extremely collaborative, and all of these different groups that are doing these have agreed to share with each of the other respective groups once they get reference samples built up and other data. So even though one university may be doing this as the PI, there's agreement to share samples and data with everybody. So this is going to be a really good collaborative process. Cell culture is a big one. Right now, TGE virus, you can grow in cell culture and it's not a problem. We obviously have antibody tests and vaccine. For PEDV, that's been a lot more of a challenge. Sabrina Swenson at the National Veterinary Services Laboratory recently published several papers on how they are actually doing cell culture. There's specific cells called varicocele cells. They're green monkey kidney cells. And they have certain nutritional requirements, such as trypsin and other things, to be able to actually grow and propagate this virus. For whatever reason, this one's buggered. It does not want to grow. It does not want to propagate. So therefore, it's very hard to be able to develop virus isolation tests. So normally, if we're doing swabbing or testing, if we get a PCR positive, we would go to virus isolation, grow it on cell culture, and tell whether that virus was alive or not. We don't have that ability yet. We're working on it. So we did fund some additional studies to look at that and develop a standardized way that that method can be shared then with everybody else. We're doing epidemiology. Like I said, we want to look at what is the lateral spread of PED. So we know, you know, we've got some characterization of the first farms. Now we want to know how's it moving within the country, between farms, within states. So that's another focus we'll be doing. And that's, again, defining risk factors. Are our risk factor assumptions correct? And do we need to be looking at other things? Again, I was telling you about the funds request for next week. We're looking at validation of samples other than direct pig contact. So things like oral fluids, we still need to validate for PCR. Feed samples and other environmental samples, because we know the virus can exist on other fomites, but we don't really have a good idea of how well these tests that we have for pig samples will do on other samples. So we'll be evaluating those. I said the epidemiologic investigation, but that may also include further and deeper investigation into feed. Before, when USDA did their evaluation, they were looking at a premix made at the feed mill. They did not necessarily go back and pull it out of what we call straights. So the straight product of whether it was a vitamin E, whether it was your proteins or lysines or things like that. So that may involve going backwards and getting further sampling and working with folks to get that done. We just have to wait and see what the final assessment is. And then environmental studies, really looking at concrete, wood, water, recycled water, slurry, manure, all those things, and that's some of the things that we're requesting some additional funds for. And that, I think, I know it's a lot of stuff. Boop in 30 minutes.
I have a dumb question. This virus has been around in Asia and Europe for years. Probably the best researchers in the world are in Europe at the Frankfurt Fleury Institute and at the University of Kent and things like that. Has there been, like, get these guys on the phone and tell us, or are we saying if we're American, we can do it better, we can?
You know, there are some differences. There has been, I think, in contact with some people, kind of more on the researcher level, just because some of the key people that we know that have done coronavirus research have been in contact with them because they discuss on a level I can't. But I do know at least the European strains that they have are genetically different from what is in Asia, and so we also had discussion with folks in Asia on this. I know Dick Hesse's been in contact with a lot of folks in Korea as well as a lot of practitioners as well. So we do have a lot of their examples and things that they're using. There are some differences and nuances. I think with the growth of it, we're taking advantage of that. But as far as some of the on-farm things, there are some differences in how production's going. So that's why we still wanted to repeat some of the testing and things here in U.S. soil and some of our controls. But yeah, there is a lot of discussion going on with those groups, and we've learned a lot clinically. But now it's time just to get some repeatable things in the lab. And then there's also the issue of transfer materials. You guys, just as well as anybody, know about those MOUs and whatnot. So, but the help has been offered, and I know at least early on, Sabrina was in a lot of contact with those folks too overseas.
Was there a vaccine in Asia, or has there been a vaccine that was approved in other countries?
There is a vaccine, I think, that's been used in South Korea and potentially in China. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, so they have one, and, you know, in discussions with some folks that are there, they do work, but again, it's not 100% efficacy. No vaccine has that. But the thing is in some of those countries, they also have a lot of other diseases that we don't want, like foot and mouth. So there is a lot of limitations with transferring any of that kind of technology here to the U.S., and that would be under the evaluation of USDA, Center for Veterinary Biologics. We have more of a likelihood of developing an in-state to use than we would to get it in from another country. We are working with other countries on diagnostic kits and tests because those have a little bit of a different degree of safety and security. But as far as a vaccine goes, I would not look to having anything imported in from other countries at this point in time. That's just speculation, but just knowing what CBD is and the protections that they have in place, I would not see that happening anytime soon.
Like I said, I think that some of the challenges with the vaccine are that it creates more of an endemic infection of numbers, and I think our U.S. mentality, endemic disease is not cool.
That's exactly right. So, and it does muddy the waters as far as trying to do control, and if you look at elimination. And a lot of those vaccines to work are modified live, which I don't, I think the TGE one right now does not mutate, but there's always concerns with those. So I think at this point we're just trying to get a handle on how does the virus, the natural virus in and of itself, move in the herds, and how do we best get rid of it under those natural circumstances.